documentary is about 20 minutes long, so for those of you who have knitting, this would be helpful. I feel like there's, it's so weird sitting together listening to radio, since radio is something that most people do while they're doing something else.
Like driving or whatever.
Like driving, cooking. We just did some audience research that showed that Morning Edition listeners are doing 6 different things in 4 different locations while they're listening, and Austin City listeners are doing 3 different things in 2 different locations while they're listening. Mm. So we know that people are pretty distracted while they're listening to us.
But the early days of radio, people sat around together.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. People sat and listened to fireside chats and stuff. But
this fireside chats.
People don't do that anymore.
It's too bad.
Now every,
so
you don't 4 even listen
different
with
things in 6 locations? Is that
6 different things in 4 different
locations.
4 locations. Did you take that as a
fact?
No, I mean, like, you wake up in bed, that's one location, then you are in the bathroom brushing your teeth, and then you're in the kitchen,
cooking your
locations.
Breakfast, and then you...
You're, you know, showering, getting the kids up.
Closing the washing machines.
Right, right. And
folding clothes.
A little less in the evening because you're basically driving home. And yeah. A few people
oh, yes.
Turn it on in the kitchen to cook.
I'm just leaning forward. My parents are here. Cold.
Interesting.
No, it just means that you've got to make the pieces so captivating that you'll just listen. While you're doing other stuff. Well, welcome everybody. This is the final session of the listening room. Tonight's session, instead of doing 3 or 4 pieces like we've done the rest of the week, I wanted to play one longer piece. This is a piece called The Gods of Times Square. It was produced for radio by Dave Isay. So it's about 20 years old, and the recordings, the producer, along with Dave Isay, did in the year leading up to this. There's also a book called The Gods of Times Square with some of the still photography from this. And there is a video documentary of this as well. It's about an hour long. I've watched the video documentary, and I don't think it's as good as this radio piece, but I think it includes many of the elements we've talked about this week. I think there's a really strong sense of character, because you meet each of these street preachers, and each of them becomes a character in the piece. But unlike some of the other pieces we've heard, the reporter also becomes a character. The guy who was doing the recording, the photographer, he started as a still photographer, then started taking video. This piece was produced from the audio from that video. So he becomes a character in the piece as well. I think there's a ton of tension in this piece. I wouldn't say conflict as much as tension, because Adam Sandler, the producer, is really disturbed by street preachers, and so he's trying to understand them, and so a lot of the documentary is him going back and forth with the preachers, trying to figure out what this place is. And then I also think there's an amazing sense of place. How many people here have been to Times Square? Okay. So was anybody to the old Times Square, like the pre-95, like, okay, so just a few of you. It used to be.
I think we old folks over here.
I was there.
We're there in the 60s.
Right. Well, I was there like in the late 80s, early 90s, and I just remember it being this really, really gritty place.
Oh yeah.
And this, he was recording in basically the year before, like, Disney took over, and before there became like a big Virgin Megastore and
the Naked Cowboy.
Before Good Morning America moved there, and you know. So now it's really like a mall. It's like an outdoor mall of America now. But he's there this moment when, you know, things were about to change, but we didn't know they were about to change. So that's also like, I think it's this great piece of sort of documenting something that just no longer is. And then he has this amazing conceit that I don't want to give away, but you'll start to get it as he goes, and why he ends up calling it the Gods of Times Square. So think about the various preachers, the various characters, and it's about 20 minutes, and then we can just talk for another 20 minutes afterwards about what you thought of it.
Is this a different Adam Sandler than the Adam Sandler that people watch TV?
I'm getting his last name is Sandler, but it is not that.
Yeah, it's not
Sandler is his last name. Why can't I remember his first name? It might be Adam. Richard Sandler. I don't know. You're about to hear what his name is. You're also going to hear the old All Things Considered music, the good All Things Considered music, where he came out of tune clarinets.
Yes.
Siegel. Times Square is a special spot of Midtown Manhattan. It teems with people, countless thousands of them, day and night. They're commuters, shoppers, theatergoers, merchants, prostitutes, and policemen, hardened New Yorkers and wide-eyed tourists. Times Square is a swirl of images. The anxious crowds gathering around the moving news ticker in times of tragedy, the sailor joyously kissing a young woman amidst the tumult of VJ Day, and as always, the lights, flashing signs, huge billboards, the garish neon. 2 years ago, a photographer named Richard Sandler began a project taking pictures of the signs and the lights, but it wasn't long before his focus began to shift from the sights to the sounds of the multitudes of religious believers who were also drawn to Times Square. He switched from a still camera to a video camera and a microphone, and he began to record the preachers and missionaries who've made a portion of Times Square their dominion. Richard Sandler takes us along now on his journey among the gods of Times Square, produced for radio by David Isay. His prayer would be one more voice in a chorus of zealots. Why is it that Times Square is a mecca for modern-day religious pilgrims who come to this place to inquire into the nature of God, to argue, to pray, to convert? I know something persistent and powerful drew me there to discover the gods of Times Square.
In all four directions,
Times Square vaults skyward, forming a natural cathedral-like structure. To the north and south are the huge buildings Number 1 and Number 2 Times Square. Number 2 Times Square at 47th Street is the cathedral's entrance, a wall of neon affixed to the outside of the Renaissance Hotel. 5 blocks south, Number 1 Times Square is the spire and altar, the place where hundreds of thousands of boozy supplicants gaze skyward to view the falling ball, which denotes the first instant of another new year and counting since the birth of Jesus. The celestial lights of this place of worship are not stained glass, but the primary colors of neon. They radiate a pulsing, buzzing force field, holding its congregants in thrall. Within the grand cathedral that is Times Square, there are smaller chapels where turf is staked out by believers who either preach on their own or as part of a group.
Television is really television. You'll have a lot of time in hell to think about the Dave Letterman show. You'll have a lot of time in hell. You'll have eternity in hell.
The most persistent and visible of these groups has appropriated the corner of 43rd Street and 7th Avenue in front of the old Nathan's restaurant.
God's got a final say on this!
The Pope is a
liar! They will have their part in the
lake of fire! The Pope is a false prophet!
A half dozen preachers pass the bullhorn in front of the long table draped with gruesome pictures of botched abortions.
America is not a Christian country. The wolves, there'll be no bars, there'll be no liquor stores, there'll be no abortion clinics, there'll be no homosexual parades in California, in New York, in Chicago, Washington,
Are you guys going to be out here in the middle of the winter? Every day?
The beginning, the middle, and the end of the winter.
Every day?
Every day, as usual.
Preaching the word, right?
Preaching the word. Yeah.
You guys are dedicated.
Oh, thank you.
What do you do for money?
I work for the government, post office.
When do you work?
From 7 to 3:30.
And then you come out here and preach?
Yeah, my lunch hour and now, yeah.
There are so many different gods out there for men. A Hindu god, a Muslim god, a Christian god, a black god, a white god, an Indian god, a Chinese god.
How many gods do you think are out here in Times Square?
Well, you got the god of money, you got the god of sex, you got the god of adultery, the god of crack. I remember in the 60s when they used to write Eric Clapton is God. Eric Clapton, the singer for Cream and now he's on his own.
The Beatles said they were bigger than Jesus Christ.
And the Beatles, John Lennon, said that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus Christ.
The first Beatles to die.
But the first Beatles to die was John Lennon. And the Beatles, just before they broke up, they said, all you need is love. So what happened to the love in the Beatles group? We learned that the Beatles, just before they broke up, they started blaming each other. They said, well,
Korean husband and wife preaching team stand on the corner proclaiming the imminent return of Jesus. The husband holds a large cardboard sign of a barcode with the numbers 666, the mark of the beast, underneath it. These symbols, they say, will appear on the backs of the hands of the ungodly at the time of Armageddon.
666! 666!
I saw you 2 years ago at the Democratic Convention. You said the world was going to end October 28th.
Yeah, October 28th. I'm
October 28th. Yeah. 92.
Oh, hallelujah, yeah.
But it didn't happen.
No, no. Jesus came already into the heaven.
In the air.
Jesus coming in the air. Heaven.
Already. But you don't see. You don't see. But
I heard your group sold all their property, took their kids out of school, went back to Korea. Sold everything.
All over the world, I don't believe.
But it didn't happen.
Yeah.
A few people sold. Not many people. Only a few people. Okay? Okay? Hello, you must be in Jesus. Hallelujah. 666.
Even in the face of false prophecy, their belief system remains unshaken. Across the street from the Koreans, a different kind of prophecy.
Read! They shall surely be put to death!
You shall be put to death, you so-called white man, and you black man too. The scripture tells you to stop following this white man! Come out from amongst him!
By far the loudest and most strident voices to echo off the walls of the Times Square Cathedral are those of the Hebrew Israelites. Clothed in homemade biblical garments, leather and metal studded, they resemble Old Testament warriors. They stand on a podium amidst large wooden stars of David and written messages proclaiming that the fall of the white man will be engineered by a vengeful black Jesus. They read Bible scripture in the urgent tones of an angry town crier. They claim they are the original and only Jews. Most of those passing, white and black, quicken their pace. On one oppressive summer day, a Hebrew Israelite pulls me over and tells me to start recording.
George Bush, Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, all you white people, get ready for war. We're coming for you white boys. You white boys, Ku Klux Klan, get ready for war. We're coming for you white boys. Negroes are the real Jews. Get ready for war, white boy. You want to get on my knees right now? Or you get the hell out of here.
I won't get on my knees, but another man does, skinny and pale. He voluntarily lays on the pavement as two Hebrew Israelites each place a combat booted foot on his back while a third preaches.
You so-called white men, you had over 400 years to extend your hand to the world and to share this kingdom with everybody, but you wasn't meant to do that. You were set up to be the devil on earth. I take my hat off to you, you've done a good job. You've done a good, excellent job of being evil and wicked and perverse. And deceiving and deceptive. Love is going to be brought in by Christ when he destroys you and puts you in slavery. That's the love that Christ is talking about.
Through it all, the white man remains on the ground, boots on his back. After about 10 minutes, the Hebrew Israelites lift their feet and command this martyr to crawl away.
Sir, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Tell me about your experience right then and there, okay? When you were laying down on the ground.
I mean, it's like, I'm just not going to hate anybody. It's beyond me. I just like the hatred and the rage because it's just not a good thing. I mean, I can't see why people have to hate.
What are your religious beliefs?
I have no real... I just believe in God. I have no fundamental religion, you know?
But what is your work? What do you do in life?
Well, I'm unemployed at the moment, so I don't have a job, so...
Unemployed? Ain't nothing in you.
Oh, I got guys, so, but I just say that, you know, I've got to forgive them. If you want to hate me because of what my forefathers did, then so be it. If they want to take my life, let them, if it makes them feel better. But I'll just ask God for forgiveness. I'll see you later.
Outside the Church of Scientology on 46th Street, a young, heavy-set man stands beside a table of books. It's hot and smoggy, but this man in full business suit does not sweat.
Dianetics will improve you. Dianetics gets rid of problems of unwanted things about yourself.
And what's been your own experience?
Well, Dianetics has improved my ability to communicate with people, my self-confidence, and my certainty.
Your level of certainty in your life.
Yeah, I'm certain about everything.
You certain about everything now?
About everything that I know
about. What are you not certain about?
What I don't know.
What don't you know?
Well, I don't know what I don't know, and I know what I know.
He's our best book salesman.
Wandering dervish. Religion is Times Square.
creator of the universe bestowed upon everybody in Times Square.
At Times Square's northern extreme, a bearded, wild-eyed Old Testament oracle rants,
"You've got to think of this before you kill your very own baby!"
His Bible in hand, he gathers all his energy, pauses, then spews a sheet of sound which thunders through Times Square, glancing off skyscrapers and billboards and sending people scattering in all directions.
"Abortionists! Why did not your mother kill you?"
"Is he out of his mind?"
"What do you think?"
"I don't know, sort of." "He's not normal."
"Homosexuals! God gave you AIDS! God says homosexual are to be put to death! Leviticus
20:13. I think a homosexual experience would do you a world of good."
"You make it a carnival! Homosexuals, Philip, Sodom, and Gomorrah! Look at them! The filth, the scum of the earth! That's why God kills you idiots with AIDS! God is not..."
47th and Broadway. A Salvation Army brass band plays below a clothing advertisement that shows two young, good-looking men in an embrace.
"You realize you people are playing in the shadow of a billboard advertising homosexuality. See that up there?
Yeah.
The Benetton ad. That's two guys intended to be in an amorous relationship. What do you guys think about that?"
What do I think about that?
I don't agree with it. You know, why would God have created homosexuals in his grand plan?
God didn't create homosexuality.
You don't think so?
I believe man created homosexuality.
But didn't God create man?
Yeah.
So God sort of knew it was going to happen. If God knows everything, God knew it was going to happen.
That's the sin of the world.
Maybe everything's okay with God, you know? Maybe everything that happens is okay with God. There's like nothing wrong, you know?
No, I don't think so.
What if we had a vision of a positive God that tolerated everything, that was compassionate and didn't really have a problem with, you know, what humans want to do?
Actually, I think we do have a God who is very tolerant of us. He's so tolerant, he hasn't destroyed the earth for what we do.
Destruction. Apocalypse. After more than a year in Times Square, the doomsday rhetoric and self-righteousness fuse with the unending sensory overload of this place. At times, it seems to me like a roaring, swirling Tower of Babel, and nobody hears each other, and nobody wants to listen. A microcosm of the religious wars that have plagued humanity throughout time.
"Okay, if they found this opponent, they got it out with.
So much auguring and so much
masturbating too much stronger. Masturbating. I don't feel that Jesus did. I don't feel Jesus Christ did all that. When I read the Bible, I don't think Jesus. I don't see nowhere in the Bible where Jesus Christ did that.
Did what?
Forced people to believe in it. Christ wants us to reason. Christ wants his people to reason together, not standing and arguing about the color of a person's skin. Not standing and debating, cursing, carrying on, and fighting, hitting, punch. That's not the way. That's not the way Christ would act.
This is Richard Sandler.
He's a professional photographer, and so.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
He's not,
so, did I understand him correctly to say, Richard Sandler, to say that he was a Jew?
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah.
Makes sense. I thought it was interesting that, because he ends the piece with, mm-hmm. with a pretty powerful voice. I don't think Christ would have said that, or I don't think he said. I don't know, I just found that very interesting as a Christian to have a Jewish man say that. I felt like he was saying
that. Well, he's letting somebody have the last word.
Yeah, you know. Right. The person that he chooses to have the last word, in my mind, is one of the only ones that has it right.
Yeah, the one who couldn't take it, who had to get out.
Yeah, and to leave that part.
Yeah. I think that man at the end and the guy in pretty much toward the middle of the piece, the guy who gets down on the ground and lets the Hebrew Israelites
stand
on his
shoulder. I don't want anybody to hate.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Richard really likes those two guys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're the only really likable people in.
Yeah.
There's this really interesting, sophisticated thing that he does. There's that time with the Hebrew Israelites, and then we meet the guy he describes as the Old Testament oracle. Mm-hmm. And those are so intense. And he's really smart to then have a little comic relief where you meet the Dianetics guy.
Yeah. Yes.
It was just you giggle, because you need this is 22 minutes of sort of sensory overload and, you know, really basically a lot of mean stuff is said throughout this, but every once in a while he gives you these sort of comic relief. But he starts the piece with this, and he's got this grand idea of the Cathedral of Times Square, and he's sort of walking you around Times Square meeting people. But there's this moment when I think he's just sort of had it, and he yells at, it's about, I don't know, 15 minutes in. It's the first time you actually hear him really kind of sort of lose it with somebody, and he goes, a homosexual experience would do you a world of good.
He
says that.
Yeah. Yes. Isn't he interviewing the Salvation Army?
No, this is before the Salvation Army.
The guy that was talking about
the Oracle.
The Sodom and Gomorrah.
The guy with that really, really sort of scratchy
voice.
The guy he describes as the Old Testament Oracle.
Okay.
It is a great piece for giving you the sense of the sensory overload.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
And I can remember the first time I saw it was a junior in college, 68, and it was a rough area. And I'd grown up in Minnesota.
And you were at Manitou Heights, so you were in,
yes.
The bubble.
So my girlfriend and I, little Chrissy from Iowa, and we'd gone out there to study at a hospital in Brooklyn, in the Bronx. And we went downtown, and it was just that same sensation as that. It was just because it was full of prostitutes, it was full of people high on drugs and crack, so different than when we saw it a few years ago. But it was that constant blaring lights, and it was just, I mean, we just stood and kind of shook all over because we couldn't figure out what was going on. Yeah, and he did, then it really picks it up in this.
I really liked how he framed it as a cathedral and sort of described the landmarks and then walked you around it. Because then it didn't feel like just this cacophony of noise, but that there was sort of fixed points that he was sort of taking you around like a tour.
Right.
It still felt like a cacophony of noise, but that sort of gave it a little bit of structure. So that
you need some
survive.
Structure to,
yeah.
to understand
yeah.
what's
And I thought
going
that was
on.
A really brilliant way of doing it.
I mean, this is... I'm a little sad that we don't do pieces like this as often. Mm. And in part, it's because this piece, what people in my end of the world as an editor think is, it's a producer-centric piece. It's really the producer's art that he's working on, and it's not necessarily thinking too carefully about communicating a specific idea to the audience.
Sure.
But I actually like that there are many levels on which you can approach this piece. And it's not meant to have a... I think you're meant to feel a lot of different things about the place, about the physical place, about the things that are said in that place, and about Richard's own experience in the place.
I really liked the length of that at night. I thought this is something that would make me late for a meeting, because I would stay in my car and I want to hear the end of it. And what I thought was really interesting is right when I was thinking, gosh, isn't there anyone sort of who's calm and loving, and I wonder if there were any religious leaders who he didn't interview who were just sort of reading or praying with a nice little sign that says, if you want to talk to me, you can, but you aren't looking in your face. And then it's like right when we started to interview the person at the end. Like just getting to that, okay, I need a break from this, and then it was perfect.
Well, of course, doing a documentary about street preachers means you're not really finding, like, the thoughtful Presbyterian pastor from suburban Kansas City. This aired originally on Christmas Eve of 1994.
Oh, wow.
So, I just remember it made me late for church, in fact. So I like sat in the car waiting to hear this. And it actually, this is a piece that I generally say inspired me to go out and do religion reporting. It took me another, three or four years to become a religion reporter. But it demonstrated to me what was possible with radio and getting people to think about complicated religious ideas. And, I think that it's kind of a messy piece, but I think it's trying to be messy. So every sound that you hear is layered on very specifically. I don't know how many of you have seen like multi-track editing, but he had a year's worth of audio, and so he's mixing a lot of that cacophony. And some of the cacophony is natural, but when you're, especially at the beginning and the end, where he's sort of doing this waterfall of the various preachers, so it's a cacophony, but it's a very controlled cacophony, and he's trying to give you the experience of being in this place. I think what's so amazing to me about it, and I know I said this at the beginning, is that this place doesn't exist in the same way anymore.
Yeah.
And the 20th century is the first century of recorded sound that there is, and I'm just amazed that I'm so grateful that there is a record like this of this thing that doesn't exist anymore.
It doesn't exist, and yet. Coming from the Bible Belt, those messages are very familiar, sort of shaming and sort of God hates you, basically, whether you're gay or not, for being human.
Right.
I was raised at LCMS, but just being around Southern Baptists and being around the fundamentalist camps we discussed, it's almost more damaging, but this is so over the top, it's easy to dismiss, but you still hear the same messages, they're just a little more subtle, you should be ashamed of yourself for being human.
That's true. It's sort of easy to dismiss a street preacher, too. Because you think, what is this crazy person doing preaching on a street? Like, don't they have a job? Like, how do they end up there?
And then you find out they work for the post office.
I know.
Yeah.
But I loved how he brought up,
Oh, Benetton.
Yeah.
Yes.
One of my experiences is the American Geophysical Union Conference in San Francisco, and it's set up, there are two different buildings that are kitty-corner across the street from one another, so there are 25,000 scientists streaming back and forth between these two buildings, and in the middle there's often a ranting preacher screaming at all these scientists going by.
No.
Hired by the conference, I'm assuming.
Light entertainment.
You're right.
Exactly. Just to jar you a bit.
I get a sense that, you know, even though he clearly finds a lot to disagree with, there's kind of a begrudging admiration in a sense. And for some, you know, like with the postal guy, he has to say, you're here. Probably he works from 7 to 3:30. On his lunch break, he goes out, and then he goes back.
Right.
Ever, all year long, as usual. Because I think there's a sense of how messed up, but also like, wow, I gotta hand it to him.
I've never heard it as admiration, but I've heard it as fascination.
Sure.
I mean, in the same way that, like, you know, I think a lot of journalists are just sort of perplexed and fascinated by these things, and you just end up like wanting to hear people tell this, just because how could you go do that? And you just want to talk to them about it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Was there any part of the documentary that you didn't like or didn't understand?
Was that the call, a prayer to the Muslim, to the in the beginning? That part was beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I
don't know
that.
Why it's there, though. I've never understood that.
I was just going, because it sounded like it was in a different location, like I was in.
Well, no, there's a mosque in Times Square.
Okay.
But I just, it seems a little out of place because it's really
it's
about Christian
thing.
street preachers.
Yeah.
So you asked if there's anything I didn't like. I guess I didn't like the understanding of Jesus' message that I was hearing. To me, it was very disturbing.
Yeah.
That a message of love could be so twisted. And
yeah.
I think that's the good news, or that's the gospel.
Right.
I don't know. Just how do we get there? How do we,
I mean.
And so many different people come and arrive. You know,
right. I think. I remember who mentioned that at the end you meet the guy who might, you know, have figured it out. He couldn't live in that cacophony and that with that message. But I don't like it, but I just find it's kind of relentless.
Mm-hmm.
And the editor in me thinks maybe we could have made this a 15-minute piece that wouldn't have felt quite so relentless. And there are a few ideas that I think are like a little too harped on.
Hmm.
Like, I think there's a lot of gay stuff in here that's like more than I would have put in a piece or left in a piece. But I also think like 20 years ago, maybe that was really important to talk about as much as they're talking
and
about.
And abortion, right. Don't you think those were kind of the hot button issues?
Yeah, and it's not that they're not hot button today, but they're like,
but
the conversation is different now than it was 20 years ago.
Was this 1995?
These were recorded in 93, and this was aired in 94.
Huge issues
at
that time amongst religious groups. They were huge in schools.
Right.
I was on the school board at that time,
mm-hmm.
and that was a constant topic at every school board meeting. Every piece of literature was looked at to see if it promoted either abortion or homosexuality in small towns. So this it was front and center.
Right.
For religious, it was really fun. front and center on making sure that curriculums were not promoting either one of those. That was huge in the early 90s.
So I guess today it feels like there's too much of that, perhaps, but 20 years ago, it's what people were in fact
absolutely, especially
about.
If very conservative. Groups and the kind that would
probably be preaching or handing out tracts. Mm-hmm. That was the sure way to hell, mm-hmm. either one of those.
Mm-hmm. We went to a lot of pro-life rallies and I was mm-hmm. yeah, waving the signs, and you feel like really honored if somebody flipped you off because you're somehow being persecuted. Which is a similar thing now, you know, like people disagree with you being persecuted.
Yeah.
But we also have ice cream afterwards. So no, about the same time, early in the 90s.
I couldn't understand, I mean, physically understand some of it, so I may have missed it, but it seemed like there was a lot of, there was a lot of black on white ranting. I didn't hear white on black. Was it there?
I mean, I think there's a, there, especially with the Hebrew Israelites.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I think that, I didn't hear a lot of sort of white.
That was the most startling one to me.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, I didn't expect that much hate.
Yeah.
Yeah, the hate and the fear was palpable.
Yeah. I find that one the hardest to listen to. Yeah. That section is the hardest. But I also think it's probably a very important section to keep in.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we kind of want to romanticize oppression sometimes, you know? it's like we don't want to see it kind of rear back and it's, yeah.
Well, I've gotten attacked for bringing the topic up, that there is reverse racism. Mm-hmm. I've had people just go after me. Like, okay, I grew up with it. But,
yeah. As an editor for pieces on the radio, I heard this whole thing and I thought, other than sharing a glimpse of culture, is there a message? And it just seemed to me like it was just presenting the cacophony of Times Square at the time with that slant or that cut, but it didn't seem to have a direction or a message other than just Times Square is wacko.
I would disagree with the ending of the piece and saying that, you know, the guy so level-headedly saying, you know, I don't think Jesus is that way.
Maybe if it was a 12-minute piece, I would have heard that, but I was kind of beginning to wander in my reaction to the noise and sort of step away. I wonder where he's going with this. And I missed that actually and didn't hear that any.
Yeah.
Our Bible study topic last week, not this past week, but the week before, was prophets. And so I think that's part of what was coloring my listening to it. And one of the things that I heard was a criticism of prophets, if that makes sense. You know, and that's a lot of what I heard was kind of a criticism of Christian street preachers.
I think it's a pretty critical piece. It's pretty critical of street preaching and the messages, most of them being pretty hateful messages. That, and you know, this is the part that this is very much the producer's piece, and why I worry that it's not a very audience focused piece. You know, this is very much sort of Richard Sandler's take on his experience and placing, what if he had placed, so if you think of this whole piece as discrete sections where you meet the different preachers, what if he had, like, started it with the guy he ends with? I think it would frame the whole piece very differently. What if he hadn't put the Old Testament oracle and the Hebrew Israelites together, or near the middle together. And I think that there are just many ways that you can affect the experience of the audience by just placement in the story. I mean, I often say that the end of the piece should be the point that you want to make. But as you point out, in a 22-minute piece, what if somebody doesn't stick with you? It's dangerous.
You know, normally when I listen to things, I expect them to be more like an essay, and this was more like poetry.
Yeah.
which is very interesting. I mean, if you tried to take yourself back from it and not get emotionally invested in any one point, but just keep going with the flow of it, it was very interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's very much an affective. It's meant to give you an experience,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that like any experience, it's not necessarily meant to be heavily didactic.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the ending makes it a little more didactic. But I think mm-hmm. that he wants this to wash over you,
mm-hmm.
and to give you his impressions, and then allow you to form your own impressions after having
mm-hmm.
had all of that sound wash over you.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that we're. I don't remember who I was talking to the other day about movies, that there are movies I watched in the 80s that I go back and watch and I'm like, it's boring. And I just loved them at the time. I think in the last 20 years, it's really we've gotten less patient.
Our attention's
gone. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The guy at the end, I thought, was redemptive, but also very sad. It felt like he had been damaged, and like he was a survivor.
Yeah, yeah.
He did. He sounded
damaged.
It was just so sad to hear what he had to say. I mean, I was glad he got to that conclusion, thank goodness. But you could tell that he had been affected by that. Yeah. I kind of wondered why he was there. Why was the street preacher? Why was that particular street preacher still there?
I mean, he wasn't still preaching. I think that Adam just...
He was just a bystander.
Preacher just talked to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're pretty much out of time. Any final thoughts?
In some ways, I thought it was a criticism of Times Square, too, the excess and the commercialism, and the which was an interesting backdrop, I think, for the preachers.
I mean, I think I love the two images that he starts with, or the image that he starts with and the image that he comes to about three quarters of the way through. He has the Colossus of Marky Mark with Kate Moss, which I think is a great, his writing at the top is so beautiful. I just love that opening invocation. And then there's the point when he's like asking people to comment on the Benetton ad. I just think that's really the contrast between what's going on below and this whole other conversation happening, in the heavens above people.
Yeah, we can be. Yeah.
Right, right.
He had caught the flirtations halfway through. It would have been great comic relief. Did you ever hear the flirtations? They're a gay a cappella band or group that sang in New York streets.
Oh, so do they sing in Times Square? Or?
I don't know for sure if they sang in Times Square. I could never hear them in New York, but of course I heard them in the Northwest. But, they're from New York.
It's really saying something about the U.S. I mean, it's saying about the excess and all, but it's also it's also pretty remarkable that people can say, I mean, no matter how hateful, but they can say whatever they want there, and they're not carted away. They're not taken. Some of them are probably mentally unstable. They're not taken away. They're not. I mean, it does say something about our freedoms. It says a lot about our excesses. It says a lot of the things that aren't pretty at all about the country. But there's also some kind of, ugly beauty or whatever you want to say in the fact that you can stand. I mean, I saw in one time not long at Lake Street, Minneapolis, somebody was standing on top of a car just ranting and raving. And, you know, there's something about that it's just, it's not allowed a lot of places, but it can happen here. So, it's really commentary.
I mean, I come back to the title called The Gods of Times Square, because there are just 1,000 different gods in this.
Yeah.
You know, each preacher seems to have a different god.
Yeah.
And then there's the also just what Times Square is, and then there's the ads going on above. There are a lot of gods in Times Square.
And to air it on Christmas Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's...
It's interesting, too.
It's really interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I had the pastor's piece on Christmas Eve. So that aired on Christmas Eve on Morning Edition.
Mm-hmm. And then the guy that gets the last word is the only one that has kind of escaped the cathedral, the church.
I like the idea that like people probably heard this on their way to Christmas Eve services. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just an interesting idea to think about.
Yeah. How was it clicked off?
I'm sorry?
I mean, how often was it clicked off at that time? And what were the editorial or what were the comments that came out?
You know, this was before we had online commenting, thank God. Think of online commenting as like the CB radio of our day.
I've never gotten, and I don't know that we still,
at that point, we probably did not keep a lot of records of the letters that we received. I mean, now I think it would get, you know, anything that we report, anything about religion gets just tens of thousands of comments and letters and, like, the whole level is crazy. And as I was telling somebody the other day, like, I really don't pay any attention to what's written online, but if somebody figures out how to find my email address, which is a little obscure, and then they send it to me, then I'll interact with them. But
So how'd you feel after listening to this on Christmas Eve and going into service? I mean, was it hard to sort of shake it?
You know, I experienced it so much less as like a religious thing and more as a like an amazing piece of radio. And I like wrote to Dave Isay and like I want to know how you did this. Like, tell me about, you know, your the method of producing this and how did you work with Richard on this.
Okay.
I was already like deep into like being
the
a
method.
Radio journalist.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
Well, thank you all so much for coming to these.
Thank you.
Yeah.